Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological revolution. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives, from industry leaders to government officials to advocacy groups and academics. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create fair and practical legislation. Today, we are honored to have with us Professor Ramaya Krishnan. He's the Dean of Heinz College of Information Systems and Public Policy at the Carnegie Mellon University, where he also directs a university-wide center called the Block Center for Technology and Society. He's also the W.W. Cooper and Ruth F. Cooper Professor of Management Science and Information Systems. He currently serves on the National Advisory Committee to the President and the White House, and is a fellow of several prestigious organizations, including Informs and AAAS. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Krishnan.
Thank you, Sanjay. Thank you for the opportunity.
Wonderful. Professor Krishnan, as I said, we have a global audience, members of Congress, senators, think tanks, staff, industry. They would be very interested to know, obviously, your extensive background. Given your extensive background in academia and policy, what sparked your interest in AI regulation? And also, I want to let our listeners know before you answer that you're speaking on behalf of Carnegie Mellon University and not for anybody else. So, Professor?
Thank you, Sanjay. I've been trained in engineering and technology. And as you know, AI has been around since the mid-50s. In fact, Carnegie Mellon is one of the birthplaces of innovation in AI. Herb Simon was at that Dartmouth meeting when they even came up with that term. When I was a PhD student was when I first got introduced to artificial intelligence. So it was a different generation of artificial intelligence. It was the expert systems generation of artificial intelligence when I was at the University of Texas. And right from then on, I've had an abiding interest in thinking about the ways in which artificial intelligence, optimization, these different methodologies, how can they help make consequential decision-making be better? And over these years, what's happened is that AI has become such a major transformative technology, going far beyond the capabilities that existed in the 80s when I was a graduate student to where we are at today, where we see not only the traditional predictive kinds of artificial intelligence, but you see the generative approaches to artificial intelligence and many tools that for the first time have made AI available to the common lay individual to actually engage and interact with, like the tools like Gemini and ChatGPT. So when you have this kind of transformative technology, along with that innovation comes great opportunity, but also come potential downsides and risks. And so this issue of governance, issue of regulation, and what public policy should be doing, both to advance the pace of discovery, engender innovation, but do so in a responsible way, began in the mid-80s, has continued, but then on account of the transformative role that AI is playing, is certainly something I'm honored to be able to contribute to the policy discussion that's ongoing today.
You talked, Professor, just now that it has great potential, great opportunities, but also has great risks. There have been all kinds of polls, studies done that the general public is concerned. So for our audience, in your view, what do you see as the biggest risk from artificial intelligence that need to be regulated?
I mean, if I think of, let me use one example of an opportunity and one of a risk. For those members of your audience that have children, You've probably seen Khan Academy and the ways in which kids learn using, you know, originally the videos from Khan Academy. Khan Academy has a new a service or product, Khan Amigo, which basically combines the power of generative artificial intelligence with this learning content to actually help kids at every level of the ability distribution to become better learners, to understand, to be better writers, better understanding of history, better understanding of algebra. My own kids, who are much older now, used Khan Academy in the old version. But if I see the power of AI for education and making it accessible, making it available both to teachers as well as to individual students, I think that's one of the examples of the power and promise of AI. Now, but where are the potential risks? If I take an example of AI being used, for instance, in recruiting, where people apply for positions, and if you have an AI that decides who will be advanced in the recruiting process and who will be denied, I think you're going to see the potential risks that arise from not having an AI that is governed properly, imposing very significant costs on the individual and society, especially when something called a type two error happens, which is when an AI is used, it either can commit errors of omission or commission. That is, it includes people that should not have been included in the interview process, and that cost is borne by the firm. But if it excludes people that should have been included, that cost is borne by the individual and by society. So this is an example of harm that is being caused. And I can give you an example similarly in health, in issues of law enforcement, so on and so forth. But I think the examples all illustrate the question of errors that the AI could commit, and who bears the cost of those errors and what harm is caused. And therefore, when we think about governance, we need to ensure the guardrails are put in place, taking these costs and harms into account.
So you made two points, Krishnan. One was the opportunity, as you just talked about Khan Academy and Khan Amigo, giving probably equity, education equity for across anybody. If you're a kid in a rural area, inner city area, you have now access in some folks call it personalized education, personalized tutor, whatever you want to call it. But there is, and some people are saying there could be health equity potential too. But then, and we'll come back to that, but then you also now talked about variety of risks by omission or commission that happened. Now, we've had many regulators, Congress members of Congress, etc., that come in. What are some of the key challenges in regulating AI? You talked about the errors and omission and commission, especially if you want to keep fairness and equity in mind.
So, I think this is very clearly a challenging exercise. I think the questions of how to measure, evaluate, and monitor AI systems is still very much a topic that requires research, that requires advancements in our capability to better understand how to do this well, just to lay that on the table. It's not like we know exactly what to do, and then it's only a matter of figuring out how to put it to work. So with that said, I mean, for instance, we have the NIST having stood up an AI Safety Institute with very much this in mind, to have a public-private set of discussions where the private sector, the public sector, academia, civil society can all sort of have discussions around what the issues are that need to be addressed. And the key aspects of AI systems that make it particularly challenging are, one, that the kinds of data that are used to train these systems, particularly we are talking about AI, by the way, as you know, is a broad term. In particular, I'm focusing on these large machine learning-based systems. And those systems are so dependent on the data that go into them. So issues of understanding what went into the AI. So I think of this as nutrition labels. You know, so when you when you buy a bottle of juice in a grocery store, it tells you, you know, all the stuff that went, what are the ingredients? Mm-hmm. And it also tells you how much sugar, how much protein, how much fat, et cetera, right? And if it's good for you. So I think it would be good to have the equivalent of nutrition labels for AI. And that's challenging because today, even the quote unquote open access AI models from Meta, from Mistral, from Technology Innovation Institute in Abu Dhabi, which are quote unquote the open source vendors, they don't tell you what exactly are the data that their foundation model or large language model is trained on. And of course, OpenAI and Gemini and Google and Anthropic don't either. So we don't know. They provide a high-level description using what's called a system card or a data card or a model card, but you don't have complete clear data about what, clear information about what went into the AI. And that's why you have these lawsuits of the sort that you have New York Times suing OpenAI, and we can delve into, you know, some of these issues. So issues of ownership, issues of IP, is the data biased or not? Is there, are there concerns about adversarial poisoning of the data to ensure that it will behave the way it is supposed to? I mean, these are all data-related exercises that we need to have an understanding of. The second piece is, once you've trained the model, how do we know that the model will behave in ways that that will produce outputs as expected? The, for instance, again, using generative AI as an example, we know that it's a next token prediction type of engine, and it does so probabilistically, which means it's a stochastic system. That's why if you go to one of these chat GPTs or Anthropic, in fact, I did this with Claude 3 the other day. Claude 3 is considered state of the art. I put my name in, and it'd be interesting to put your name in and see what it produces and see if it's accurate or not. It gets many of the larger themes right, but it did have errors. So for instance, it said my PhD was from the University of Pittsburgh, or it had errors that were factual errors. So one kind of issue on the output side is evaluating. So how do we evaluate an AI on multiple dimensions? One of those dimensions is, you know, is it accurate? Another dimension is, does it produce toxic content? Another dimension is it biased or does stereotyping, et cetera? So evaluating the outputs of an AI and then going farther to ask the question, can adversaries attack the AI in ways to get it to produce outputs that it wasn't designed to produce? So for instance, suppose I said, can I tell me how to build a bomb? ChatGPT will say no, politely decline that request. But as work has been shown at Carnegie Mellon, you could actually create something called a suffix attack that can effectively provide that same prompt, but then produce a lot of additional suffixes after tell me how to build a bomb, which actually can break the guardrail that has been put in place. And ChatGPT, and it's to be fair, every one of the large language models, in fact, this is a systemic risk that exists across these models, will comply with a toxic request. So this is now an issue of, you know, is it safe with regard to the guardrails that have been put in place? And then finally, when you actually deploy it and field test it with users, when errors are committed, who bears the cost of those harms? Like I was telling you earlier about the type 1, type 2 errors. So to summarize, if you think of three key phases, how do we evaluate the model intrinsically? How do we know what data went into it? What outputs come out of it? How well does it do? Second, can we red team these models to understand how well they perform in adversarial conditions? And then third, when we field test the models and apply them, get them to actually be used, remember most times AI models are not used in and of themselves. They are part of a system. So the harm that is caused is not caused just by the model, it's caused by the system, by which I mean it could be people, processes, and AI models in place. So I'm giving you a sense for the complexity of evaluating them and certifying them as being reliable and safe. That's why I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. It's not like there hasn't been work, there has been, but there is more that needs to be done to build a science of measurement and evaluation to ensure you have the capability to assess safety and reliability.
So, Christian, what you said is there are three aspects. One is the data. Second is obviously, you know, the measurement. And third is where do you assess the risk in terms of the developer, the builder, and the implementer. And those would be the three things. Couple of questions when our, well, there were many, when they knew you were coming was one of the questions was, and this is really a member of Congress kind of question is, how do you balance innovation versus regulation? We are an innovation economy. And, you know, that's the one question is how do you balance that part? And the second question related to that came for you was that AI is a constantly evolving technology. Look at what's just recently happened. Jensen Huang has now talked about a new chip. We've got multimodal, we've got agents, you know, and next week there'll be something else. You've got Sora, et cetera. How does regulation keep pace with that? So those are there are many others, but two that I wanted, that they wanted to answer.
Let me take them sort of in reverse order. So with regard to the three steps that I laid out, I think it's important to recognize that so much of what we need to do with AI is going to be in the context of use. That's why when I said field testing of users, what I do in healthcare is very different from what I want to do with recruiting, very different from what I want to do in autonomous driving. So context matters, right? With regard to keeping a pace with the rapid... the idea is not to regulate technology per se, because it's changing. And in many cases, like the recruiting example that I gave you to begin with, or the healthcare example, AI might be a means to an end. So if you regulate the outcome, meaning if you think about something like the Fair Credit Reporting Act, it's about giving people loans or giving people credit. And there is an existing regulation pre-AI that exists, that type of sectoral regulation might be perfectly reasonable in these verticals where AI happens to be a means to an end. Just because you're using AI doesn't mean that that particular context or use case or application does not need to be overseen and governed and regulated. It will be. AI just happens to be an intervention that is used to decide who gets a loan, who doesn't get a loan. And you want to make sure that that is done in a fair, unbiased, effective, and efficient manner. So there are multiple dimensions to this. So to your question about you know, the rapid pace of change, indeed, that's why it's not about saying, you know, let's regulate the technology per se, but think about the context of use. Now, certainly, the intrinsic evaluation of the model step, that first step that I talked about, that will take into account the nature of the model and the technology, because how you evaluate a multimodal and multilingual AI model is going to be different, especially if it takes, for instance, pictures as prompts or audio as prompts or video as prompts versus just textual prompts. It's going to be different. But nevertheless, I think these three steps that I laid out of model intrinsic model evaluation, red teaming, and field testing, keeping in mind context matters, I think is a reasonable approach. Now, with regard to the balancing point of balancing innovation and regulation, I think at one level, you could argue this is a false dichotomy, that it's not as, you know, if it's one or the other, because you could, if you think about the distinction between model development and deployment, and then what kinds of due diligence can be done pre-deployment and what needs to be in place post-deployment, it's a fair argument to make that if you require a level of due diligence that prevents people from deploying. You know, the balance, if anything, is how much work do you need to do pre-deployment? And how much do you have to do to recognize problems that arise when you deploy, both with regard to incident reporting, as in, you know, these kinds of errors happened. These, at one level, you could draw a parallel with information security. So imagine a software vendor creating a piece of software. So let's say pick Microsoft OS or something like that in before AI. I went ahead and really, I did some software testing. I did validation. I did quality assurance. And then I release it. So the testing and quality assurance work that I do prior to release is work I do pre-deployment. Then I go ahead and release it. When I release it, I might find that there are bugs that people encounter, people discover. These have to be identified, reported, and then I have to have a mechanism to try and patch them and push patches out. I might need mechanisms like the bug bounty program so that I can identify bugs before they become broadly known to malicious attackers that might use these bugs to take advantage of them, et cetera, right? So we have an existing model from cybersecurity of what work needs to be done pre-deployment, and then what infrastructure needs to be put in place post-deployment. By infrastructure, I mean things like the CERT, the Computer Emergency Response Team, that basically keeps track of these reported vulnerabilities, does forensic analysis of them, risk tiers these vulnerabilities, lets the upstream software developers know what the problems are so that they can be fixed. Now, let's take that and now say, what is the AI analogy of that? Okay, what I just described was for software and cybersecurity. Right. Is there an analogy? Now, some of it is analogous, some of it is different. But as a structure or as a framework, I could imagine that you want to do model evaluation and red teaming and field testing prior to deployment, but in some way titrated or calibrated to the risk tier of the AI application that you're deploying. In other words, if it's a Netflix recommendation system, if I recommend a wrong movie to you, not such a big deal. It's not super consequential. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I could imagine that if it was a healthcare diagnostic application, that's a much higher bar. So the level of due diligence that you'd need to do with regard to model evaluation, with regard to red teaming, with regard to field testing, and doing impact analysis of harms that might be caused because of errors in the AI, like in that recruiting example, that bar, and in fact, the EU AI Act actually formalizes it by sort of saying, you know, AI applications have these tiers that are the unacceptable tier, the high risk tier, the medium risk tier, and the limited risk tier. And for each of these tiers, there is a level of obligation on the model developer to do this due diligence. Now, that said, post this due diligence, I'm going to deploy, and then there is this issue of incident reporting, figuring out what the errors and vulnerabilities are, and how I might need a cert, like an AI cert, to actually keep track of what these problems are that arise upon deployment, and try and assess them, risk tier them, and then have the model developers fix equivalent of patches for them. And in this closed loop kind of way, we move to a safer, more secure AI ecosystem. So if we can do this, I think we also have innovation happening. Remember, there are two kinds of innovation. One kind of innovation is new kind of models being created, of the sort that you mentioned, you know, there are Sora, then Gemini with a million token context window, et cetera.
Right.
But there's also innovation in how to do measurement and evaluation of AI models, which that innovation might lead to an entire new industry for certifying AI models. So much like the with financial statements, when you had the generally accepted accounting principles, that created a whole industry of auditing companies, right? Like the Deloittes and the PwCs, mm-hmm. et cetera. I could imagine that there is innovation happening and will need to happen in measurement and evaluation of AI systems, how to monitor them at deployment time, at runtime, et cetera. And that, I think, is going to be a new capability that also is a kind of innovation. That's why I'm saying it's not regulation versus innovation. I think the regulation might require innovation as well because of the needs of these kinds of models. I know it's been a long answer, but I hope that gives you a flavor for the set of issues that are relevant.
No, it does. I want to pick up on two points that you mentioned. One is you mentioned the EU AI Act very briefly. As you know, Parliament just approved it, and in the next couple of years, you're going to see, hopefully, the implementation. What are your thoughts on international collaboration for AI regulation, considering that AI is a global technology, Krishan?
Yeah, and I think this is, without a doubt, a really important question. Both for American firms that are going to do business in Europe, and this idea of global harmonization of standards of the approaches is important. Now, I think if I might take a moment to say, you mentioned that we are an innovation-oriented the U.S. Indeed, but if you think of what are the three big drivers of policy, it's one is the market, you know, how do you promote markets and innovation? Mm-hmm. The other is human rights. And the third is states' rights. So you'd argue that the US typically has been a proponent of a market-led innovation model. It's not like the US doesn't care about human rights or states' rights, it does, mm-hmm. but innovation and markets have been the primary driver. Mm-hmm. And then on the Europeans have been a human rights-focused policy regime, and going back to the GDPR for privacy, mm-hmm. the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act, mm-hmm. you know, DMA, DSA, and GDPR. Mm-hmm. And then the Chinese have been more of a states' rights-based model. And as you know, they passed a directive on generative AI in September of last year, actually even predating the EU AI Act, right? So mm-hmm. if you think about these different models and what it then means for on the ground, what it might likely mean, it's interesting to see, at least in Europe and in several parts of Asia. I was in various parts of Asia late in December last year, and then I was in Davos and as well as in other locations in Europe earlier this year. The AI risk management framework that has been created by NIST has found broad acceptance. NIST, of course, is our National Institute of Standards and Technology. So if you think about that framework of how to think about risk management in AI, one kind of harmonization that's happened is this broad acceptance of AI RMF. That's the first thing. The second is, I think there is broad consensus around this risk tiering type approach that the Europeans have adopted, which is this unacceptable high risk, medium risk, mm-hmm. limited risk. Now, countries may differ on what they put in what bucket, but by and large, there seems to be convergence around a risk tiering type of approach. A third piece, and I think you'll see some version of the Brussels kind of effect that happened with GDPR. As you know, GDPR led to what happens in California. And then many firms pretty much adopted, because you know, from a cost of compliance perspective, the EU requires you to comply with the EU AI Act, as long as not only if you do business in Europe, but as long as European EU citizens have the potential to use your services, you have to comply. So I think the reach is broad, and it's a large enough market that I suspect that the once rulemaking happens, right, you're right to point out what's passed as the act, that it's going to take 18 months or so for rulemaking to happen. But I suspect that rulemaking will have broad impact, not only in Europe, but also in the US and in Asia, much like GDPR had. So I think you're going to see harmonization come about in two ways. One is this AI RMF being broadly supported. The second is the impact of the AI Act, which, by the way, the Europeans pulled back from an earlier version to promote, quote unquote, more room for innovation. That's itself an interesting move by the Europeans. And then the last point I'll make is the emergence of IEEE ISO standards. So that's the third part of the puzzle. The IEEE 42, ISO 42000, I think, is a family of standards around AI. Mm-hmm. So I think the combination of those is likely what is going to what you're going to see on the ground, that firms are going to start complying with and building teams within their organizations that understand these technologies. The last point I'll make is that the AI Safety Institute of NIST has created something called a CRADA, which is a consortium. And almost all the major tech companies, but also largely the downstream deployment companies, are part of that consortium. So you're hearing all these voices in these consortia. And I think through that public-private consulting model that NIST has does so well, you know, the AI RMF has wide adoption. Why? Because it came out of a public-private consultation process. So I think through these efforts, I think that's, I suspect that there will be bumps in the road, as there always are, but I suspect that this is going to be the large framework.
So you're saying, Christian, basically three, the NIST RMF, EU AI Act, and the IEEE, which will somewhere come together in some shape or form to give companies and others some standard.
And I think you'll have that. And then in the markets that they operate, the sectoral regulation, remember I talked about sector-specific
health,
regulation.
Health,
that cetera, will also drive, you know, whether are you doing healthcare AI? Are you doing, you know, that will drive this too.
Right. One other question that came for you, Krishnan, was that Washington Post recently published an article that said Silicon Valley is pricing academics out of AI research. Fifi Lee from Stanford is pushing for the government to fund research through the CREATE Act. What are your thoughts on this? You are sitting right in Carnegie at the key point of academics. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
So I think, you know, Professor Fei-Fei Li, I think, is right. And I think the Washington Post is right as well in the following sense, that if you think about this generation of transformer architecture driven foundation models, the big inputs are very large amounts of data, very significant compute resources, and then very talented people, right? Those are the three inputs that go into. And if you look at the five or so major companies that have developed the closed large language models, they all happen to be US companies in the main, though there are some interesting startups that are in the open source space that we can talk about. But they all have the resources to create these the infrastructure, the compute infrastructure, the data infrastructure, to be able to build these models. So if you are a, if you are an academic at Carnegie Mellon or at the University of Texas or Stanford or MIT, you don't have access to these GPU clusters that are required. And so one of the things that was a recommendation from our committee, but also from other committees, has been the establishment of what's called the NAIR, the National AI Research Resource. You know, because if you think about the reason for why the US has been at the forefront of innovation has been that it has democratized innovation, meaning that there's wide participation in the innovation process. Universities are a key element of that, key input into that process, along with small and medium-sized enterprises. Now, if the barriers to innovation are you need to have, you know, a very large 100, 200 GPU cluster, and the pricing of these things are north of $100 million, then there are very few universities that are, in fact, I know of none that have the capacity to provide the compute resources that, say, a Meta or a Google or an Amazon or a Microsoft or slash OpenAI have, right? So if you think about this situation that has come about, what happens is that universities find that their very top faculty may either be lost to industry. I say lost because oftentimes they, when they go there, they're not publishing. They're not, if you look at even the early work on transformer architectures, Vaswani's paper, 2017, was published and has been transformative. But if you look at the more recent innovations from OpenAI and Google, they've stopped publishing it because they see this as a big competitive race to win. And therefore, there isn't the advancement of science. Universities have historically played that role because they had the capacity to publish and had incentives to do so. But because they of these barriers, and that's the pricing out, if you will, they are unable to participate in the science. That's why most of the university projects have been open source efforts that are focused more on taking the foundation models and then fine-tuning them to create downstream applications versus the foundation models itself. Let me pause there because there are some interesting potential developments, particularly with small language models, which are showing promise, which might change the equation that I just outlined. But the existing equation certainly is one where unless you have very large compute and data resources, you're not able to do the more foundational work that these companies are able to support. And I think long run, that's not good for the US and not good for the society or the world. Short run, you might say, hey, these are all American firms. It's good for us. Yes, but long run, I think you want a more democratized process.
No, yeah. We had the director of NSF, Dr. Punch also, and he talked about how they are creating these clusters, AI clusters around the country. And you also talked about NIR. And I think in that article, they said Stanford has, I think, like 9 or something GPUs, and Meta is going to have 3,500 GPUs. So how does a Stanford, I mean, and we're talking about Stanford or Carnegie, how do you kind of compete? Taking what you just said on the open source, Krishnan, there is a debate about open source, closed source. People say, hey, open source, you know, and Mark Zuckerberg has said he's going to, well, he's open sourcing, you know, Llama 3. He's going to even open source AGI to a certain extent. There are people who say it could get into the wrong hands, the weights and stuff like that. Your thoughts on this?
So Sanjay, I just want to make a quick point. Punch and NSF are doing an amazing job with NIR. I do think that I would urge Congress to fund NSF at a much higher level because I think those resources are required to create these digital public goods. If you think of NIR, it's an example of a public good. It's a digital public good that we need, which has become going to be a key input to allowing for greater participation and engagement in this more democratized process for AI, for AI innovation that we have just talked about. Now, talking about open source, I think the NTIA, which is a part of Commerce, actually has an RFI on open source models with weights, which is what you are asking about. My own sense here, speaking just as an individual at Carnegie Mellon and not wearing any policy hat, is that I think net-net open source is going to be a very important piece of the pie, so to speak, in terms of what we should be doing. And if you think about open source in general, it's generated $1 trillion of innovation and value creation by getting, this is a great example. I mean, it's a great phrase to use is democratizing innovation. What does that mean, right? So what it means the capacity for individuals, small businesses, others to both take what has been created, but then contribute back and through that mm-hmm. crowd process, drive the quality of the innovation. And you actually are seeing some amazing, go to Hugging Face and look at the leaderboard and look at all the different open source models that are out there, including one from China. If you look at 01.ai, by the way, it's led by Kai-Fu Lee, who's a Carnegie Mellon alum. They are number two or number three on the Hugging Face leaderboard. So I think the capacity to drive innovation through open source, I think, is on the plus side. Question is, are there malicious users of the technology? At one level, you could say that for any kind of technology, but the examples that are often provided, like somebody is able to build a bomb or make, get access to content about building a bomb. I mean, the question there is, would they have been able to do so anyway with what is already on the internet? Is the big point of friction not collecting that information that a chatbot gives you, but actually getting access to the physical materials, the lab? In other words, where is the friction, right? So if you think about these malicious aspects, one aspect is what can you do in the physical world with information that you gain? The other is, and perhaps this one is a point of concern, which is, can somebody maliciously launch cyber attacks? Can they develop manipulable information that can manipulate electorates during elections? I mean, these are all very valid concerns. And the question is, can that be done only with open source, or can they be done also with the existing models that are out there? I mean, for instance, deepfakes are an example that are referenced. Could you do a deepfake with Photoshop? Which predates Gen AI and DALL-E. Mm-hmm. So it's not the case that there aren't malicious use cases. Please don't get me wrong. It's not that I'm downplaying the potential risks, but taking both the benefit side of the equation and the cost side of the equation, I do think that there is value in open sourcing these models, and by having the weights made available, it allows for a level of fine-tuning and further customization that would not be possible if the weights were not made available. So that, and unless I see something, profoundly different, that would be where my position would be.
So the benefits of open source outweigh potential downside of that. Right. Krishnan, yeah. Krishnan, do we need a separate regulatory body? A lot of our guests come in and say, hey, look at nuclear or look at the FDA. Is there a need for a body, whether it's a global or something, to regulate AI?
I've gone back and forth on this, to be honest. I can convince myself on some days that yes, it does. And one reason for why it does, and like these things, right, there isn't a black or white answer. It's like not zero or one, because there are...
At the end of it, I'll tell you what the consensus of our members of Congress is, but I won't give you the answer right now, please.
No, I think the argument in favor has been that by having a single point of contact, there are issues of how do you resource this agency? How do you attract talent to this agency? How do you get intentionality and focus? And then can you have one organization in the US that actually represents and can engage with global partners? Those are all on the pro side. The alternative model would be, do we already have this capability, except that it might be distributed. It might not be just in one place. And do you want to have more of a coordination model versus creating a brand new agency? These are sort of, and I'm laying out two alternatives that there might be in between models. And like I said, I could go back and forth, convincing myself on one day that this is the better model versus that's a better model. So I don't have a this is the model to use and here is why this is superior on all counts kind of answer.
Well, we've had many guests who come in and say, yes, we need, we don't. The consensus, I'll tell you, for members of Congress, even the ones who want, it's very difficult in this current political environment to create another bureaucracy. It's all going to be almost, in some cases, they say bureaucracy, in some cases, whatever, it's going to be very, very difficult because a lot of them say the same thing. We already have, you know, we have the FDA, we have the FTC, we have the Department of Justice, on and on and on. We have the National Labor Relations Board, etc. So we'll see. One other question that came...
But Sanjay, the quick point on that is by having all of that, I agree that was my point, that you have all of that, but coordinating those is a challenge as well. Yeah. And who will represent us as a single voice in globally or internationally is also a fair point.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm just telling you about the political reality.
And I don't deny that.
Yeah. The other question that has come in for you, Krishnan, is that there are a lot of job displacement and societal upheaval that are being talked about. Whether you look at McKinsey, you look at IMF, etc. You know, numbers up to 60% or 30% or whatever. These are massive numbers. You are working with students and telling them, hey, you go. We are teaching you, go out into this workforce. What is your message given? This is the question. Given all this news that you're saying, what should we be, and what should the government be doing from a regulatory standpoint for something like, or is the government should be doing anything?
Yeah, I think there is work that the government should do, but here is my point of view on this. So the study that I'd like to use is the OpenAI study that was done by a colleague of mine, Daniel Rock, where they basically say 80% of the jobs will have at least 19-20% of their tasks impacted or exposed to the AI, and I'll come to what exposed means. And then maybe 29-30% of the tasks have a much larger proportion of their task exposed to the AI, right? And we could go back and look at the exact numbers, but the argument is that that as AI develops, there could be a very significant number of tasks that might be exposed. I think the question of does exposure translate into job losses is the fundamental question, and nobody knows. So my view on this is that we need considerable situational awareness for individual leaders, for policymakers, for business leaders to understand how this change is what is happening, right? With regard to is this technology substituting? Is it augmenting? Are new jobs being created or new roles being created that didn't exist previously? I think there's a whole collection of things that are likely going to happen over the next 3 to 5 years. And rather than speculate as to what might happen, I'd like for us to build the situational awareness capability. So for instance, having almost an observatory that monitors job postings, that monitors the kinds of skills being demanded so that we have an understanding of what the labor market, how that is changing, right? That is one. Mm-hmm. The second piece is that we need to help individuals. In some jobs, let me give you two examples from in the past. When the automated teller machine came out, everybody predicted that was the end of tellers in banks. It turns out we have more tellers today in banks than we had when the automated teller machine came out. However, they don't do the same debits and credits that the old teller did. So while they are called tellers, the skill set that they employ is a very different skill set than the debit credits work that they did previously, right? So I think it's really important to understand how the skill sets that are going to be required are going to evolve, number one. The other counter example I'll give you is, if you remember in the old days, driving on a highway or a tollway, you used to get a little ticket from a toll operator. When you entered and you gave that ticket and you paid for the toll when you exited, nobody does that job is gone. It's completely substituted, right? So the issue really is, will the technology evolve to a point where it's only going to change, it can do some of the tasks associated with the job at the level of reliability that the task demands? And if so, does it then change the nature of the occupation or the job, like the teller example? Or is it going to be like the toll operator setting where it displaces and substitutes? That substitution, in the other case, it was actually transformation. So which of these will happen? Well, there are going to be some jobs that are going to be substituted, without a doubt. And so I think it behooves the government to have situational awareness as to who may be affected and providing those individuals with information about what kinds of occupations are there that are close and proximate to the skills that they have, what upskilling and new training can they obtain, how might they actually get the resources, meaning money, to pay for that upskilling retraining? Should there be like an individual training account, like an individual retirement account that we need to provide people with? And can we provide individuals with knowledge of what occupations they should be potentially seeking to get themselves ready for? I think that's work to be done. And much like with individual workers being informed in this way, and here I think unions can play a role, I think not-for-profits can play a role, governments can play a role, universities, community colleges, you know, I think we need this collective action driven by data. That's where situational awareness comes in. And we have a project called the Workforce Supply Chain Initiative at the Block Center that that I lead that does this work to support transitions. Because I think for people who are affected, we need to help them transition from the occupation they're in to occupations they could potentially move to. An interesting and an open question is, if you're 60 years old and you have this kind of impact with regard to the occupation that you're in, where it's being entirely substituted out, what is the best thing that the government can do for you in terms of upskilling you and training you versus if you're 25, because you have another 40 years ahead of you versus you have another 10 years ahead of you in terms of career, that is. So I think there are some really challenging and open questions for us as a society that policymakers will contend with, that business leaders will contend with, and people like you and I have to contend with as we think about what the impact is. But I don't think it's a pat answer as in, okay, this many jobs are going to be lost. I don't think anybody knows. I think there's a lot of speculation. Therefore, I'd really like more fast response capability to be built ahead of time that is data-driven, that can intervene as changes happen, rather than wait for the change to happen like it did in the past. You know, I live in Pittsburgh. We had the steel industry, go away in the late 70s, and there was a humongous amount of pain that was borne by individuals. Here, if we know what is coming and can at least use data to drive that decision-making, can we help workers who are likely going to be impacted while being hopeful and optimistic that there may be new jobs created, there may be new opportunities that might be coming to the table as well? So that would be my response to your question.
Those are excellent points. So you have situational awareness. That's very important. Be data-driven. Keep a track of what job losses are happening, what new jobs are being created by AI. And the government, you know, you talked about the toll person. If a person's job gets displaced, the government should be ready ahead of time in preparing them, whether working through unions and industry and others in doing that, is what you're suggesting. No, those are excellent points, because it's not just economic. You talked about Pittsburgh, and you go down to Ohio and other places. Those are societal impacts too. It's when you lose a job, it has ripple effect, and whole family and an entire society gets impacted. So we need to learn from the changes, the transitions that have happened before. And that's why bringing those people early on in this conversation, and what we do in our podcast, Krishnan, is we are bringing in people from manufacturing. We are bringing in people from community colleges, because they all need to have that understanding. Because as I said, it should not be where they say, hey, it's the two coasts that make decisions. And then they are the, as they call it, the flyover people that are there. Everybody flies over them and nobody thinks of them. But you've given some great, great recommendations, Krishnan. I could go on and on and on. We'll need to have you back. But final comments for our listeners. You've been just fantastic. I've taken you in so many different directions, but some final comments for our listeners.
No, thank you again. I think this has been a phenomenal conversation. Thank you for such a engaging conversation and a set of really important questions, like you noted, and we covered ground ranging from technology to AI safety all the way to workforce. So I'm really looking forward to coming back and learning more about where how these changes come about and how we might best work together to help society.
Thank you so much, Krishnan. This has been really, really great. We've gained some valuable insights into the complexities of AI regulation and the importance of fostering fairness and equity in this rapidly evolving field. And your expertise and experiences have been very, very valuable. So for our guests, please stay tuned for more thought-provoking discussions on the intersection of technology, policy, and society. Thank you so much, Krishnan.
Thank you again. The honor is entirely mine. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.